Fade in. Interior Screenplay Podcast Day. Welcome to the show. David Ferrier here. This is the first time we've done a TV pilot on the show, The Good Wife. It's a good one. The Good Wife is a good one. My co-host, screenwriter Kia Wilkins, is here. And today's guest who chose The Good Wife is veteran screenwriter Sarah Walker. I've got a little bio here I'm just going to read through because I don't want to get anything wrong. Sarah Walker is a highly experienced Australian author, screenwriter, and script producer. She's currently in development with US production companies on a number of TV series. We do talk a bit about those coming up in the show. She's also the script producer and head writer of the current Lingo BBC One hit, The Secrets She Keeps, and has written for many Australian dramas, including Wrong Girl, Home and Away, Neighbours, Winners and Losers, and All Saints. She also co-created and script-produced the comedy drama Wonderland for Fremantle and Network 10. She was also the script executive on the prison drama Wentworth. Walker is an Australian Writers Guild and actor nominee and has worked as a journalist in the past. We're also really grateful and honoured to have her on the first 10 pages. So this episode, this is one for the real screenwriting nerds because we talk at length about Sarah's career, making it as a screenwriter in a country like Australia and what's involved there, also branching out and laying foundations in the United States. We go through all of that. And then at about the 40-minute mark, we start talking about The Good Wife. And Sarah goes through the first 10 pages in granular detail to point out all the things that it does really amazingly well. So if you like the show, if you like the first 10 pages, a rating on your podcast app is always super appreciated. Also, you can get in touch with us. If there's a movie or a TV show you'd love for us to talk about or a guest you think we should have on, get in touch. First 10 pod is where we are on social media and first 10 pod at Gmail. It's not the number 10, it's spelled out T-E-N. So first T-E-N pod, first 10 pod at Gmail. All right. Let's do it. The first 10 pages, episode 9, The Good Wife, with Sarah Walker.
You know what I don't get? Why you stood by him?
I was unprepared.
An hour ago, I resigned as state's attorney. I need to atone for my personal failings with my wife, Alicia, and our two children.
You all right?
2 months ago, Peter Florek was sentenced to 10 years for bribery and corruption.
Not only are you coming back to the workplace fairly late, but you have some very prominent baggage.
Last time I was in court was 13 years ago.
I was 12.
How do I do it, Alicia? I'd be huddled up in a ball somewhere.
Come on, don't give up on me. I love you, love you.
Sarah Walker, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Why The Good Wife? Out of all the TV shows and movies in the world, why have you chosen this one?
It's a really good question. It's interesting because it is now quite dated, and I was thinking about this earlier. It's something I have taught writing quite a few times at AFTERS, and I'm always looking for something which is a really great example to show people how to open a show, because people will tell you over and over, you've got to try and hook people in the next, you know, in the first 10 minutes or so, especially in television. It's different in film because people have paid for their ticket and they're going to sit in the cinema regardless. So you can take longer to hook them into a story. But in television, they can just switch channels. So one of the really important things that people want in TV is to grab you by the proverbials and make you sit there and watch. But how to do that, how to set up all the information that you need in a show to tell you who the character is, what their problem is, what their obstacles are, what the stakes are, and how, you know, what the journey is going to be in a really brief, efficient way. And this show seems to have the opening of this show epitomizes how to open a television show. I think the problem for me now, like using The Good Wife as an example, is because it's a procedural. And I don't think, you know, procedurals now are not really in fashion, and I think there's a good reason for that. So how relevant it will be to everybody, I don't know. But because we're just talking about the opening, and I think it still remains a fantastic opening to a television series in terms of setting up the character.
Have procedurals fallen out of fashion because of the way we binge now?
Yeah. I'd say that plays a massive part in it. I think there's also, because film has not died, thankfully, but it's in a coma. I think what has happened is that people are now perceiving television shows as a long movie. And so they want a story that's ongoing and they want to get into the thick of the characters and into a storyline that's going to sustain over maybe 8 episodes instead of, in these cases, when I was working in procedural, there were 44 episodes a year. So you had 44 hours a year that you couldn't, you know, I suppose you had to sustain the storyline with guest stories, if you like. And so, yes, our ideas about how we watch television have changed, and what great television is has changed. And I think one of the really interesting things about procedural, if anyone is trying to write a procedural, is that the key to it is that the procedural part of it needs to be 90 to 95% of your drama per episode, and the serial element, which always remains, where you're following your character from week to week through their personal life, should be 5 to 10%, no more. And, you know, but it's the 5 to 10% of those episodes that people are watching for, but that's all they need. And so
that's what's really, really interesting about The Good Wife, though, is that it so brilliantly blends those two worlds, like all of the spheres of conflict for the main character are blurred in such a way that means they buy themselves more than the 5 to 10% where you're actually getting romance, you're getting private life, you're getting family stuff, but it all still kind of revolves around the procedural A-plot.
Yeah, they're very clever, the Kings, with this show. I think it is a fantastic, at least not all of it. I mean, I loved the first 4 to 5 seasons. But I don't think it was all perfect by any stretch of the imagination. And it's kind of now, as I said, dated, but it's still an interesting, I think it's an interesting show. It was so successful and for good reasons, primarily. I was actually looking at the script compared to the series. I'm going to say I teach from the vision, from the actual produced episode rather than from the script. And so it was interesting for me to look at the differences. And really it was all about detail. Firstly, it was about visual detail, but it was also about in the opening in particular. But later on, as you work through the script, a lot of it was just exposition. They just pulled it out because the visuals and the actors were doing it without that. And so it's not a bad script to read and then watch the television episode side by side and see what you did not need to be told.
Mm. We'll get into the first 10 pages in a little bit. I do want to ask you about your career, Sarah, which is, Kia, you know better than I do. Maybe you should ask this first question because I'm my mind is sort of reeling as to where to start.
Yeah, well, I've got so many questions to fire at you, Sarah.
Okay, here's one. Sorry to interrupt, Kia, but I've got one now.
Go on.
Just very general, what's the difference between writing? So you've been writing for how many years professionally?
Professionally for about 25 years.
What's the difference between writing in Australia and writing for the US?
It's a little unclear, but it is different. So it's strange. In America, they are they surprisingly like a lot of exposition. But American, like simple exposition, really clear. They like to know the things, you know, put all the pieces in place. They're not huge fans of letting the audience find it, strangely, even though a lot of shows seem to be that way. But what's interesting for me when I look at American dialogue, when Americans can pull it off, the rhythms of their voice are different than Australians. When we try to do exposition, I don't know whether it's because we have this upward inflection. I don't know what it is, but our delivery of exposition is much clunkier. So that's something that I've noticed that works in American scripts where it doesn't so much in Australian scripts.
Just in the mouth of Australian actors. It just doesn't sound natural. Wow.
There's something about it. They get away.
That is interesting.
Load more of exposition than we possibly can. And maybe it's about how it's directed. Maybe it's about the level of the performance. I don't know. But really, that's one of the noticeable things for me, that, you know, the stuff that I wouldn't want to write in an Australian script, I can write in an American script and get away with it because they can pull it off somehow. So that's interesting. Another thing is that in America, while you are still subject to network notes and studio notes and all the usual notes that you get from the interested parties and the buyers, they're much less likely. You actually can resist the notes much more than in Australia. And the people that you deal with in America, they tend to be younger, or they tend to be more open-minded, or potentially even creative. Whereas a lot of the people you're dealing with in Australia are very much, you know, it's not to say they're not creative, but they have a different mindset, and it's about keeping things. They like to see what they've seen before. Everybody wants to see what they've seen before. And I'll notice in scripts in America, most of the scripts that I write, if I have something that feels unique, or, you know, this is something I haven't seen before, a scene that I will write, or somebody, a character doing something, they'll love it. They'll be like, oh, when she does this or when he does that, I love that moment. In Australia, if you give them something they haven't seen before, they want to take it out. Almost invariably, any line or any action that a character takes that I've gone, wow, I've not seen this before, so here you go, that will be the line and the action that the network will come back, or the producer will come back and say, can you change this? What's happening here? I don't like this line.
Are you talking for commercial as well as, you know, the ABC?
I'm talking about everything. And I think there's just a real fear and aversion to risk. And if they haven't seen it before in America, they're excited by it. If they haven't seen it before here, they're afraid of it because they're not sure that it can be pulled off because they haven't seen it before. But that's a big difference.
I think so much of it stems from the comparative sizes of the industries as well, because it feels like here, you know, there's so few potential buyers for the product. And so there's this culture in America of like you pitch to Netflix, and if Netflix push back and go, yeah, but we don't love this or that, you're like, that's cool. Like, there's a bidding war going on. We'll talk to Amazon. We'll talk to Hulu. We'll talk to Disney. Whereas here it's like, if you take something to Channel 9, they know that they're probably the only, like, this show has been tailor-made for them because there is like 5-6 places where you can take it, and each of them have a very clearly defined style or, you know, target audience. And so they kind of know that they have more power than the creatives. Whereas in America, it's like the creators are like, well, there's so many other places we can go. If you guys aren't vibing with it, if you don't get it, that's fine. We'll take it elsewhere. And so there's just a power difference there.
Absolutely. That would have a massive effect on how powerful the networks feel over there. I mean, obviously, some networks do have more power in America, and they are more likely to put their notes out and want you to do them. But I think they are also concerned when you sell a show, because they normally won't give you notes until you've sold it, although they will give you ideas about what to do. But they'll also be concerned. They are super worried about you taking that show to someone else and someone else picking it up and it becoming a hit. And as you say, in Australia, nobody's really worried about that. In fact, you will go to a network meeting with the show, and sometimes they'll even tell you which other network to go to. You should take this to Channel whatever, because, you know, it's not for them, but they can see that maybe that's more, you know, the rival's cup of tea. And I think that's really, you know, that's so true, Kia, what you're saying.
Do you tailor yourself? Do you only try to work for American, like write for America in that sense? Because it doesn't sound like much fun to try to get something made here.
I'm not going to say it's not fun to get something made here. I think that it's a privilege to get something made anywhere in the world. And in Australia, I'm very, you know, grateful to have my career and to be working in collaboration with a lot of really, you know, fine, hardworking people. So it is easier for me to work in America because my opinion is respected much more than, and my power is greater within the process of creation and development. But each of them have their, you know, their challenges. And in Australia, it is disappointing often to, you know, where you feel like something would be better if it was given more, you know, originality or if it wasn't subject to those notes. But I think, you know, getting a show up, nobody, it's hard. Everybody is doing what they believe to be best. So I think it's done with the best spirit. And I still enjoy working with the people I work with here. I just think that it would be healthier if the powers that be in that situation were more inclined to trust the creators and the creatives rather than their financial, you know, their ideas and second-guessing what might be okay with the audience. And I do think there's still an attitude here that the network executives believe that they know what certain members of the audience want. And I've had, you know, a middle-aged man sit across the desk from me and another woman who was, you know, equally experienced as me and tell us, actually say the words, let me tell you what women want to watch on television. And it was quite phenomenal. Like, you just can't believe that he can say that and not really understand how ridiculous it is.
Mm.
And so there's that. That's frustrating here.
What about the writer's room process? Have you done, you know, because as you say, we haven't really adopted the showrunner type model here. So have you, what's your experience of writer's rooms here? Have you done any of that in the US? How do they compare, or, you know, what's that experience been like for you?
I've avoided the writer's room in America so far. As curious as I am, I have been offered roles inside, you know, staff writing roles inside writer's rooms there. I've also, you know, been asked to set up a show in America. I would love to experience it, but I've kind of avoided it because at this stage in my career anyway and in the way the world's operating, I actually have so much freedom sitting here in Australia. If they want me to do something, I can do it completely under my own terms with, you know, my own people that I wish to work with. And there is nobody overseeing me or sitting over my shoulder. I'm very autonomous in that. And I feel that for me anyway, at this point, it's been the best way to work. I'm sure that as we go forward, I think if it was a procedural or a long running or a returning, it would be different. I would probably be over in America and working with a team of people in that kind of role. But so far I've had mostly limited series or been in development with series that are returning, but those haven't moved to the next stage yet. I've actually got one at the moment that I'm doing a meeting with Pitch to a Studio, and we're now looking to take it to the market, and it's returning. And I'm sure in that case they would expect me to make a room in America. So that will be interesting. In Australia, you know, I did, wow, thousands of rooms in plotting on long series, long-running series. And that's just, you know, you have, I suppose, one writer at a time. That's the writer of the episode, maybe two. If you could, you know, you might be plotting two episodes. You have writer one and writer, you know, the second episode in the same room. And you might have a script editor if you're lucky, if they're not off trying to fix some terrible script that's run, you know, fallen over. And the producer may or may not pop into that scenario, but it's kind of tight, and it's very, at least on a returning series, it's been tight here. You don't have many people in the room. You'll have a note taker. But in America, as I understand it, in those bigger shows, they have many more people in the room, and, you know, all the writers are involved in every episode, and they have much more breathing space. So on a show like All Saints, you turned out an episode a week, and in any given week, you would have 10 different, you would have be working on 10 different scripts at 10 different stages of their process. And there was never any breathing time to do anything else. Whereas I've heard from, you know, people on expert panels, for instance, Breaking Bad, and I went to see them speak, they had weeks to sit around plotting every episode, chatting about it, and, you know, really refining.
I remember that. I was at that same panel and this collective groan just went when Vince Gilligan was like, yeah, you know, it's like, I can't even remember what it was, something ludicrous. Like, yeah, we got 7 weeks to break an episode. Like, a writer won't walk out of the room until they know every single moment of that episode. And the whole room just went like, just sighed loudly, because most of the time you walk out of a room with like kind of the five big moments of the episode, and it's like, figure out the rest on your own, and you know, and then have the rounds and rounds of notes, because people are like, yeah, this isn't what we thought we were kind of planning to do. And it's like, well, yeah, because we didn't have enough time to all get on the same page and make sure that we were all walking away with the same understanding of that episode.
Correct. So each episode here, while we may have, I'd say the standard is about 2 weeks where you get to come in and plot. You may not plot all the episodes of a series in that, but you generally take 2 days to plot after you've had your couple of weeks talking and plotting out the outline and so on. And 2 days compared to like 7 weeks or however long they had is just, you can't even imagine how many biscuits must they have had. And
yeah,
what were they talking about? I struggle to understand. Actually, I like to work fast, and there's nothing more frustrating for me than to think about. Imagine talking about one episode for 7 weeks. Oh my god!
But do you think that's because you're a product of the system you came up in, or that it is personality that you just couldn't stomach it?
I think it's both. I mean, I feel like one of the things that I do both to good effect and potentially to bad effect also is that I really like to commit to a storyline. So once I see something that grabs me and I think, yes, that's going to work and I really like that, I want to tell that. And I know there's a lot of writers, creators who love to, you know, talk for 3 days about or 2 days about one thing, and then suddenly halfway through the next day that, what if we did this instead? And that's really good too. Like, it opens up other, you know, storylines, and it gives you maybe other dimensions, which I'm not against talking about that, and it's great if you have some more space. So I've been in rooms with Samantha Strauss, for instance, wonderful writer, wonderful creator, and she'll take much more time to do the episodes than I would be accustomed to doing or getting, and she won't stop until she's, you know, she may be commissioned to write I'll plot 3 episodes, but if she's still not cracked episode one in the time allotted, she would just continue to do that and try to find her way through it and look at all of the different ways that you could tell the story or all the different stories you could tell. I find it more difficult to do that. I'm happy to be open and go off in a few tangents and really test a few things, but I'm much more likely to say, let's commit to this and then build on it.
Sarah, how did you make your connections in the United States? What was that process like?
Kind of funny. So when I was growing up, the idea of going to Hollywood was so ridiculous. You know, it was like Disneyland. It was like fairy tale. And it was very much, you know, I grew up on midday movies, and, you know, the stories of Hollywood are that you go there like Marilyn Monroe and you come crashing down and you'll be disappointed. And I feel like, you know, it was so far removed from anything creatives were doing here. Yes, a couple of actors started going over there and getting famous, you know, like Mel Gibson and so on. But for a writer to do that, it wasn't a thing. And then suddenly, you know, the world grew a little smaller through, you know, communications, whatever. And Phil Lloyd, who is at Jungle, a writer, was working with me at Home and Away as an editor, and he went off to America to get an agent and to do all that with Trent O'Donnell. And all these people who had come up under me in, you know, within the industry was suddenly going off and doing all these things, and I still didn't think it was something that I could do or would do. And then Phil came back one day, we were having lunch, and he said, you really should be doing this. Like, you should go and get an American agent. And I had dreams still of making films at that point. I still do. Film is still my great love. I never really even wanted to get into television. I only worked in it because that was the only way I could make a living, writing. And then, and it was by accident. I didn't pursue it. I had a phone call one day when I was working as a journalist, and there's a TV producer, Des Monahan from Screen Time, saying, hello, I'm a TV producer. Would you like to come and work in television? Because I was writing children's novels and so on at the time. Anyway, I thought, well, why not give it a crack? And so I got a recommendation through Phil for his agent, Gersh, and they agreed to see me based on my work, based on my credits. And so I got that appointment, and I rang a manager who recommended me as well. I mean, sorry, another producer recommended me to them. And that management group said that they would see me, and they would set up a whole raft of meetings in America. And so I kind of went, cost me like, you know, I didn't have a lot of money to go, but I went, okay, here's my investment. Bought my tickets, off I went. And on the management company never got back to me. So the day I was leaving, I was actually literally on the plane with my phone still on before it took off with one meeting. And I was going over for 2 weeks, and I was like, you're an idiot. Why did you think that you would go to America, to go to LA and get an agent? Like, it's so silly. And then I got a message from that management company saying that it was a very small company and the owner of it had died suddenly 2 weeks earlier.
Oh, God.
And, you know, which was tragic, but what had happened was that I had then fallen through the cracks. They did not have any meetings for me, and they couldn't set them up in time, but they still wanted to meet with me. So I had that meeting as well. And I also had another meeting. I just happened to have I'd seen some kind of interview with a guy called David Greenblatt, who was a manager agent, and I rang the company on a Monday from work, from Wonderland, and forgot it was Sunday there, and he happened to be so I wanted to send him some stuff, and he happened to be himself in the office at that moment, and he happened to answer the phone.
Because his assistant had the day off. No one to screen you.
No one to screen me. He answered the phone, and when I explained who I was, he said, well, look, it's Sunday here, but you've happened to get through to me. So, and I believe in these kind of karmic things, as most LA people do. They're very superstitious, and they believe in kind of luck and, you know, timing and all of that. So he said, I think you better send me your work. So I sent him my work, and then he said, yes, I'd like to meet you. So in the end, I had those three meetings. But my meeting with Gersh was on the first morning, Monday, first morning at 10 a.m., first meeting, only real meeting. And they all sat down and in a row. I think there was Jeff Greenberg, Lynn Finberg, David Rubin, and a woman called Brandy Rivers. And four of them interviewed me, and when I said I was there to get an agent to make feature films, they all just shook their head. And I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean, no? And I said, well, have you not noticed that film is dead and you have 20 years as experience as a television writer and television is now king? You are suddenly like at the top of your game and the top of our industry. So you are not going to be writing feature films. You're going to be writing television. And but they did not tell them that I didn't have any more meetings. And at the end of the meeting, they begged me. They all pressed cards onto me and said, please, please, we're so upset that we're your first meeting because everyone else is going to try to turn your head and have you come to them, and don't leave town without calling us at the end of the week. And so I said, I won't. I promise. I'll keep you in mind. And I went I had a great couple of weeks in LA doing nothing. And Leah Carides, who's a wonderful Australian actress, everyone would know, she was, you know, she happened to be free to take me around town. I had a dream trip to Hollywood. And then at the end of the week, I called them and said, oh, look, you know, I've decided, you know, you were the people that stood out after everybody else, and so I'm going with you. They were like, yay. And that's how I got an agent in Collingwood.
I thought long and hard about it. It was a really tough decision. But
What do they do for you? Do you send them, you know, like, do they set you up with meetings? You send them your ideas or spec pilots and they try to connect, you know, the relevant people to try to get things made?
I did send them some original. Well, they sent the first trip I had, I was pitching. Actually, that's the other thing Phil Lloyd said to me before I went. First of all, there was a couple of good pieces of advice that he gave me. One is make them laugh. When you get there, make them laugh because they will relax. If you can make them, if you can be relaxed in that first couple of minutes, everybody breathes a sigh of relief and everybody, the tension comes down. So make them laugh. So I got some shtick happening about being driving on the wrong side of the road, being an Australian. They all laughed, whether it was funny or not, but it put us all in the same mood. Second thing was go in with something, because I'd been told it was a meet and greet. So in my mind, I was jumping on a plane and I was absolutely smashed in Australia at the time. I had no idea to come up. I had no original ideas. But I had done some original ideas for Fremantle, so I asked Jo Porter, one of them that she did not want, I asked for her to take it back. And so I took that idea in and I developed it on the plane. I developed it into a pitch and a series idea on the plane, and it was only a paragraph when I left. And the other piece of advice was to just enjoy the meeting, because everybody that's in a meeting in America is somebody who's worked really hard to get into that position. So much competition. So they're generally very interesting people. So you should ask them questions first. You don't sit there waiting for them to run the meeting and find out who they are. Ask them what the company's doing. And then by the time they've talked all their through and they love to talk what they're doing through, you get a much better idea of what kind of pitch you should pitch them, because they've just explained to you everything that their company is interested in. And sometimes if you've got more than one idea, you change ideas. You don't pitch them the thing you're going in for. So those were all really good things. Those first meetings, I was pitching a story that never got picked up. Oh, it did get picked up, actually. It got picked up by AMC. And I developed that with them for about 7
just casually. Just a casual AMC option right. Agreement.
It did get picked up. And then sometimes I would send Jeff, my agent. I hope he's not listening to this, by the way, because he still to this day doesn't know I didn't have any more than one meeting. I actually would send him things sometimes if I came up with an original idea. But what happened was I also sent feature films, and they sent those out as samples. And then I started getting offers to develop. Or adapt books, not many. But then, as I went back, I went a couple of times a year, and I would see people and pitch different things. And then eventually, I started seeing the same people again. So they start to get familiar with you. And I took in a pitch to a woman who I'd met on my first trip. So this was probably my fourth trip or fifth trip, maybe. I went back. I had a pitch that I thought she would like. So I asked Jeff to set up a meeting with her, and I pitched that. And then she happened to have started working with Charlize Theron, who was running the company. It was her company. And they loved the story, but they didn't want it because they had something similar. But they had a book that they hadn't been able to find the right writer for, and so they offered me that book as an adaptation. And then the scripts that I wrote from that went out to town, and then I've just been inundated with work offers, most of which I've had to turn down or did turn down for one reason or another. It's a generating thing, and nobody really cares. I could go out there now with my own original ideas, but I'm so busy doing everybody else's ideas that I haven't even tried. I haven't tried for about 3 years to pitch anything original.
What's on your desk when you write? Laptop and nothing else? Cup of coffee? Do you have a good luck charm?
I have a laptop. I have a Diet Coke.
Uh-huh.
I have these two sprays. One's called Create and one's called Manifest.
Oh, awesome.
Just here.
Oh, here, we'll come back.
Usually all of my chargers for my phone, like have my phone next to me. And partly the reason I have my phone next to me is because everything that I do, every different series or project that I have a soundtrack for it, even if it's just a couple of songs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's been really an important part of my writing process, because what I found, and it didn't always start that way, but I found out in one project where it had been 20 years before I'd first written the outline, and this when I was commissioned to write the script, I'd written it as a book in between about 10 years earlier, so I was out of touch with it. But one of the things I had inside the book was two songs that I'd used, and I'd actually used the lyrics inside the book, which I'd had to get permission to do. And when I came back 10 years later, I just played those two songs and I was suddenly back.
Wow.
Utterly connected to the tone and the characters and how I'd felt about the story. And that experience made me realize that each and every single one of my projects is not a project you could name that I don't have a song attached to, or a piece of music, or several pieces of music. And when I work, so at the beginning of COVID, because all production had shut down, I got 11 projects back on my desk in the same week, 11 projects that all just came like flying back, because everybody just went, what's on our development slate? And, you know, all of these things that had just been bubbling along for the last couple of years suddenly went, yes, we need that right now because we need to get back into that. So those 11 projects fortunately had 11 different soundtracks to them, and I was able to move smoothly between them by just playing the right piece of music when I needed to get into that tone. But yeah, really, as long as I've got my Diet Coke.
What I found amazing, and I guess I don't know if frustrating is the right word, but I felt frustrated on your behalf, maybe. But in Australia, you had been working within one sort of format and genre for a long time, and you know, we're trying to expand outwards and not getting those opportunities as much. And then as soon as you can throw a name like Charlize Theron around, and you know, you come back to Australia, and all of a sudden, all of these doors are open to you, but the work was always there, and the proof that you could deliver and that you were, you know, able to work in all of these different genres. So, you know, what do you think that is? Is that just an unwillingness?
It's a snobbery, I suppose. It's a stamp of approval that, you know, they believe in, and there's a trust in the association with. So if Charlize Theron wants to work with me, I must be good. And then if that company then gets me on board, then, you know, that makes them feel like they've got something. That's
one degree of separation.
It's really, I don't resent that. I think I understand it. I think it's a shame. And in fact, there are still companies there are still producers in this country and writers in this country and creators in this country who are not interested in working with me. And if they looked at my IMDb page, that's why. The fact that I've worked with other people in America, because I haven't got anything up that anyone can look at, or very few things that people can look at. If you look at my credits don't reflect my work yet. And I've had that said over and over again. And some producers, for instance, Rachel Gardner at Seesaw, have been extremely supportive of me, and had to sell me for years to their companies because they'd read my work, but no one else wanted to, and no one else. They'd say Sarah Walker, and then they'd look at my IMDb page and they'd say, no, we don't want to work with this person. There's no proof that she can do anything. And so, you know, through sheer perseverance, people like Rachel have got my work read. And again, you know, even in a smaller instance, when I was in, some years ago, before all this happened, before my American thing happened, I had written a book, which the book that I was just talking about, that turned into a feature film, and that feature film had Rachel Ward attached. And Rachel Ward and I as a team went into a Screen Australia workshop. And Martha Coleman, who was the head of development at that point, would never have taken me on to a Screen Australia list of approved feature film writers. But when she saw me and heard me and saw my connection to Rachel, she was willing to be open to that, because in those days, if you wrote TV, you couldn't write feature film. But she considered me one of the few people who could. And I'm sure there were more people who could that just never got the opportunity. But Rachel Ward was enough to get me over the line.
Is that just like it's as simple as anything that you can do to make it easier for people to say yes? I mean, we like to think that your work alone stands on its own. But really, you know, anything that helps you get over the line, that's just sort of the world we live in.
I think it's the world we live in, not only in this industry. I think it's sometimes more prominent in this industry because the work itself, you know, seeing what people's work is so subjective. Mm. It's not like, a product that you produce or something and everybody can see what it is and taste it and, you know, whatever. But definitely, you know, whether or not something is good or bad in this industry is very subjective. And can be, it can be considered better just because someone who other people admire like it. I think working for Fremantle for so long, it's also, you know, let's face it, it's a financial thing. So one of the frustrations, Kia, you know, Joe Porter may listen to this. Joe, love you, genuinely. Joe and I had worked together for maybe 20 years on and off, and she still wouldn't give me the opportunities, and she would freely admit that, at Fremantle, because I was only allowed to do commercial television or Neighbours or whatever it was, and anything that was more interesting or non-commercial she wouldn't allow me to become part of. And the reason was because she couldn't sell me to the network as somebody who could write that material. And so even if she knew that I could do it, she could not sell me. And that, you know, and that's the case for across the board in our industry. Like, I can know that an actor could do a role, would be the most fantastic person for that role. But if that actor can't get the thing financed, and if you can't convince a network or, a co-producer that they can raise the finance, then they're never going to get the role. And I think it's the same for writers.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, time and time again, I hear the story that they had a chance, these successful writers, these people that break through, they have a champion. It sounds like that is a huge, and I mean, you've obviously been that for me in a big way, but so many, yeah, it feels like a lot of people have someone that takes them under their wing and is prepared to sing their praises from the rooftops until someone listens, and that's such a big part of it, is having someone on your team who's already got that foot in the door and has the ear of the decision makers.
I think that's true. But there are people, I mean, I know that, I've worked with John Edwards now. That was my dream, to work with John Edwards. And in a world where you didn't have America, John Edwards was the pinnacle of working in Australia. He was making great television with great creators. I think he would still resist giving me some jobs because he still sees me as a mostly commercial writer. So it's still, even at my stage, hard to change people's minds about mm-hmm. who you are and what you're capable of. If he thought of me, he would think of me for a certain type of show, but not give me an opportunity for the shows that I probably am better at writing, in fact.
Let's talk about The Good Wife.
Yeah, I was about to say, I could talk to you about the industry for hours, Sarah, but we probably should turn to The Good Wife.
Let's get on to the screenplay by Michael King and Michelle King, dated January 29, 2009. This is the pilot. So I'll summarise the first 10 pages. We open on a scandalous press conference where Chicago State's attorney, David Florek. Oh, sorry, I should just give a note. Two of the names are different in the screenplay that we read to the what they ended up with. Florek is a is what in the screenplay?
Peter. It's David in the screenplay and Peter on the
and
show.
Follick,
not Florek, yeah. Script. And Diane is Dawna. Is that, have I got that right?
Yeah. So Diane in the show was Dawna in the script, correct?
So for the sake
that was some executive that when Follick sounds too much like follicle, I can't get over it. I just can't move past this. We're going to have to change it, otherwise the show's in the bin.
So for the sake of just being able to keep track of what people would have seen, I'll use the names that they ended up with. So we start on a scandalous press conference where Chicago State's attorney, David Florek, is resigning after admitting to a failure of judgment in his dealings with several women. His wife, Alicia, our hero, the good wife, stands dutifully by his side, fixated on a piece of lint on his suit. They leave the stage and David's straight back into talking politics with his staff until Alicia slaps him hard. We're only on page two, but already so much has happened. Sarah, can you talk about how crucial this opening is? We don't hear from our protagonist at all. She's silent. How important this is for setting up the series?
I really love this opening on so many levels. Okay, so I want to talk, you know, the script, yes, it's pretty much happens what happens in the script, but there's a few other things to take into account on how it's been shot. If you would bear with me to talk about that and talk about it in terms of what was actually presented to the audience. So the opening image is two hands. They're a man and a woman holding hands. And we go from the front. So what are we being told about these people that, you know, they're obviously a couple. Hand holding is a supportive gesture. We turn around, the camera comes around behind them, and we discover that she's, from the front, we see that she's wearing a Chanel suit. So we find out that she's rich. And as we come around the back of them, she's got a massive rock on her finger. Again, rich. Again, probably a kept woman, you know, in terms of marriage, you know, she doesn't need to work. They're walking down a hallway in the bowels of a hotel. And as they're walking together, there's just sound. There's no speech. They walk into a room which is extremely elegant, and they walk into a barrage of press. And everybody's taking photos. We now go on to him. And he is he is just telling us in that moment that he is the person for whom everyone's there. In the script, they go into this press conference right at the beginning through the television, so it's someone watching the TV, and then we go into the press conference. But in this case, we are at the press conference, and we then, Alicia stands beside her husband, so we now know she's rich, married. We now know that he's an important person. We now know that something bad has happened because he's had this, and the sound will tell us that it's bad. It's very.
And that's in about 10 seconds that we've got all of that.
10 seconds. We go in and he does his speech to the press, which is about what has happened. He's a politician who has slept with prostitutes and had a bit of fun on the side. And he is claiming that he didn't use public money to do this. However, he has been discovered having done that. So as he's explaining and justifying his position, we come back around, we see, and we now go out into the audience perceiving it through a television set. We aren't shown whose point of view that is. There is no need. What we just see is the TV. We see the banner under the bottom, Florek resigns. So we know also his name's Florek. We know that he's resigning. He doesn't, and I don't even know whether he says that in the speech. He's just justifying his position. We look through the television at the TV camera zooms into her face. Alicia's standing there, silent, pale, strained, traumatized. She's standing beside her husband, As he gives his speech, she looks at him, and when he gets up to the bit where he says what he's done, you get a really tiny brief flash of her imagination of him with a prostitute in bed.
And that's not in the screenplay at all, these flashes. No. Mm.
We get back to her standing there traumatized, and then you get the back of her head. So we come back into the press conference, not in the television anymore. You get the back of her head. She's wearing her hair with a clip through, and we focus on the clip and this back of her hair. And any woman will tell you that that hairstyle is very, very, very conservative. It's a conservative hairstyle, a type of woman who wears that kind of clip, her hair straight. We then see he's sweating. So we know he's probably lying. He's certainly under a lot of pressure. And that little trickle of sweat, probably a liar. Can't be trusted. She then looks at him, and he's got his hand clutching the lectern. So the tension of what's at stake for him is apparent just in that hand movement. And then her eye travels up from his hand, up his sleeve, to a piece of lint sitting on there. And it gives you a lot of breath about that piece of lint. And then she reaches out really slowly with the intention of taking that lint off his suit. What do we know about her? She is a fucking good wife. She's a good wife because any good wife will take the lint off a man's suit. That's her job. That's her role. And she's still doing it despite the fact that, you know, she's obviously been betrayed and she's in the middle of this terrible situation. And in the public eye, that's what she focuses on. But as she reaches out towards him to take the lint off his suit, he finishes his conference, grabs her hand and pulls her out of the conference. So she's dragged out by him. Again, a kind of caveman action. What does that tell us about her? That she's not autonomous. She's an extension of him. And that she is being dragged through this situation by him. They get out of the press conference and back into the hallway, and without any thought about her, he walks forward with his aides, the assistants, and they're talking about what to do next and the politics of it. So she's his second thought, he's already gone off on his own journey. And she stops, she's traumatized, she stops walking. And then as a second thought, he glances over to see where she is, realizes that she's not with him. And so he comes back and says, "Hey, are you all right?" She still hasn't said one word. She slaps him. In the script, he goes down on one knee. You know, she slaps him so hard.
Yeah, with such force that he drops to a knee. I bet they tried to shoot that. I'm like, that looks ridiculous.
but he does not do that. Just gets slapped. And then she walks away from him because she has to get away from him. But as she walks away, she's having to walk back towards the press conference. And so through the doors, you can hear the sound of the press conference and all the lights flashing. And she stops because she can't go there, and nor does she want to go back to him. And so she turns around, she just stands side on, with nowhere to go, completely trapped and in a situation that no one would want to be in. We know now that she has been a good wife, that he has looked after her, but that he's betrayed her, and that she now, despite a public show of support, which means that she will do the right thing and be the good wife, she no longer wants to support him in private. And yet she's trapped with nowhere to go. Beautiful opening. Not one word spoken by that.
Incredible. It's so well done. And I think all of this stuff that you're talking about that is on the screen that's not specifically referenced in the script, I still think that's what great writing does, is it makes these offers for every other head of department to pick up and run with. And so just the way Alicia's introduced in the big print of the script, Alicia, late 30s, standing beside him, pretty, proper. She's always been the good girl who became the good wife, then the good mum, devoted, struggling not to outshine her husband. And so just in that paragraph of Big Print, I think all of those things that you mentioned, Sarah, would have been extrapolated from that about the hairstyle and the clothing choice and the big rock on the finger, and all of those things are actually in the script, even though they're not in the script. And similarly, that beautiful line of Big Print, which I'm obsessed with, the whole world tied up in that lint. It tells you, you know, it's not, the script never says, you know, zoom in or extreme close up on or anything like that. It's not telling the director what to do, but it is telling the director what to do just by virtue of how it's written. The whole world tied up in that lint tells you that you need to hang on that extreme close up for a significant amount of time.
Yeah. And the man who directed it, Charlie McDougall, I think it is.
I don't know who directed it, actually.
They understood the tension of it. He captured the tension and everything that was involved in that moment. But that's, can we move on from there as well? Because I think that there's what happens next.
Yeah, I'll move through the summary for the remaining 10 pages. So on page 3, only up to page 3, we're 6 months later, following a flustered Alicia as she is running late to her first meeting on her first day at work in a fancy Chicago law firm. She's thrown straight in the deep end on a pro bono case. On page 5, we meet Will, a partner at the firm and someone Alicia has history with. He's the only one who has given her the opportunity to join the firm, and there's a real warmth between them. We also learn here that Alicia is dealing with upset kids and a mother-in-law at home. Alicia then speaks with Diane, the other partner, where we learn Alicia hasn't practiced law in 13 years, having prioritized her husband's career and raising kids. Diane offers to be her mentor, women helping women, telling Alicia she's going to have to work hard to overcome her gender, her time away, and the scandalous baggage following her around. And then we get to the A plot of the episode, the case of the week, a retrial of a woman accused of killing her ex-husband in a fake carjacking. And there's a bail hearing later that day. We're still only on page 8, but we may as well stop there because there is a lot to process. A lot's already been laid out. And there's a lot of people we've met, a lot of tables have been set.
Before we get into how they did that, and again, so economical, beautifully so, the case of the week is not the same as in the script, so that changed. Mm. And that would be, you know, that often happens, especially in a pilot script. And often that happens because somewhere in episode 3 or 4 is a better case, something that's more interesting or juicy or may set up something for the entire arc of the series. So I'm not sure why that decision was made.
Is the case that is that it's not too difficult to just swap and change those if
usually.
They don't? Yeah, usually, yeah.
But what they have to do is hit the same points for the character. So often, for instance, in an All Saints episode, you would want the case, you'd want the medical, it was a medical show, you'd want the medical case to in some way elicit what you needed emotionally to get out of your core characters. It was always about how that case affected your characters. And in this, you know, maybe they found a case that better reflected what they needed to have happen for Alicia. But looking at the next steps in that, just in scene by scene, you cut from her standing in the corridor with nowhere to go to a close-up on her hands with a pen and some paper at a desk, and she no longer has a wedding ring on. That's, first of all, she doesn't have the engagement. Mm.
Is that in the script? Noted that in the script, or that was a directorial choice?
I had a look at that. I looked really closely at a few other scenes, but I didn't look at that.
You keep talking. I'll have a little scroll through. Okay.
She then, she's sitting there by herself. Already what we see is that she has a completely different hairstyle, much more contemporary, much sexier. She's wearing much more contemporary clothes, more cool. So she's changed. And she's changed physically, you know, through her presentation to the world. So she now looks like a not like a very conservative wife. She now looks like a woman who is trying to be independent and who is more up to date. She is sitting there and she's anxious, waiting, and then she realizes she's in the wrong place. This happens in the script. What I noticed, though, was that there were a couple of extra lines that were taken out. All she does is ask, come out and ask someone, I'm looking for the meeting, the staff meeting. And she's told, that's her first line, she's told it's upstairs. So we discover here that she, several things, she's no longer sticking by a marriage, at least publicly. She is no longer, she's now in a workplace environment. But she is disoriented. She doesn't, it's clearly new. In the script, they spell that out. She actually says to the woman, it's my first day. I'm looking for, she doesn't need to say that. So they've taken, it's my first day out. All she says is, where's the meeting? And she goes, it's your one floor down. And then she runs in high heels. Absolutely, you know, discombobulated by it. Runs upstairs, which I think is interesting because that she could have got in a lift, but, you know, that whole idea of the panic and the breathlessness of having to run up these stairs in high heels and run along the thing. And then she gets to the meeting and stands up the back. She sort of falls into the back and it's in the middle of the meeting. She's missed most of it. She doesn't really know what's going on. A few people clock that she's late or that she wasn't there. And then she's told by, you know, the boss starts handing out the things that need to be done, you know, who's taking what case, and he gives her the pro bono cases. She has no idea what he's talking about. And so she looks at a board in the background. That's all in the script, and she sees pro bono and a name there, and she's like, oh, I don't know what's going on, but I've got to look like I know what's going on. And then they leave the meeting. Again, only one line's been met. One line has been uttered by her, and we know. So let's just stop right there before we get any further and say, apart from all the other things that we knew about her, about being a good wife and now she's becoming this independent woman, by now we know what her obstacles are and what her goals are, what she needs to do and what's at stake. And then we're only a few pages in and we know that.
You know what else I love about the writing throughout this opening is that there's some editorial stuff in the big print, which I think is another way in which the writers are putting onto the page a tone and a playfulness that, you know, because if you just read the legal stuff in this script, it could seem like it's going to be just another quite dry legal procedural, but there's some these little touches, like when they go, we're in a press conference, and then you get a bit of his dialogue and it's like, yeah, and I'm sorry for what I did with, you know, a lapse of judgment with these women. And the big print says, oh, it's that kind of press conference. Yeah. And there's such attitude in the big print where there's this sort of tone of like, you know, everything is going to be infused with this sort of tired feminist, like, fuck this shit, we've had enough. And with such brevity tells mm-hmm. you what the tone of this show is, such a tongue-in-cheek, wry kind of playfulness.
It's interesting because it is quite serious, and, you know, in that opening it's very, very tense and very, you know, dark for mm-hmm. her, but yes, having that in gives us a sense that we are going to be able to, this character can be playful, this show can be powerful. That's a good point, Pia.
I love as well how when they set up David or Peter, as he's later to become, they call him a backslapping Bill Clinton type, smart, funny, and calculatedly seductive. Like, what a brief to get as an actor and just be like, what a role.
Not only that, but the final beat that I would love to speak to you about, I mean, you may wish to speak about other things, but I think leading to that point, I've got something to say about that. She follows Will down the corridor. So Will, what we discover, he does nearly all the talking in this scene as well. we discover very quickly that they have a connection to each other that's from the past, from university or college, whatever they call it there, that he's given her this opportunity and only because he knows her. So she's, you know, called on someone that to give her a job that she probably wouldn't have got otherwise. We already sense that there's some sort of attraction from him, but without it being heavy-handed, it's just, you know, that there's a goodwill between them. And then she covers up the fact that she doesn't know what the job that she's just been given is. So she's trying to survive in this new world without giving away that she's already behind the eight ball, already out of her depth. And so she then gets introduced to Diane, who's one of the wonderful core characters, who's now got a spin-off of her own from The Good Wife.
Mm.
But Diane gives her a speech. Then again, we do learn in the in-between time when she's talking to Will, because her phone goes off with a, it isn't the piece of music that's used in the script. It's something from the X-Files, I think. So she was then, because it's such a distinctive ringtone, Will laughs and says, "Oh, whose ringtone is that?" And she says, "It's her mother-in-law's." So it tells us what sort of person her mother-in-law is. And she says, "My daughter put it in there." And so you also know that they've got kids now. So there's conflict
and
between.
It just never feels like exposition either. It all feels very organic.
Yeah, and because she's flustered, and then he hands her over to Diane, who then, that is expositional. She fills us in by asking her questions that she half knows the answer to, that Alicia can tell us. So we learn about the history with Will. We learn how long it's been since she worked, and then Diane gives her a talking to about gender in the workplace, and this is about men can afford to be lazy, women can't. You have to do double the work that a man does to keep your position here, but you even more so because you've got this baggage and the public profile and so on. So we also hear very clearly what her obstacles are going to be in her new workplace and the expectations and what's at stake there. But it ends, and this is the point, what I wanted to say compared to what you just said about the Bill Clinton thing. Anyone watching this show in 2009 is not going to be unaware that it came very close on the heels of Hillary Clinton standing by Bill Clinton saying that he and Monica Lewinsky did not have sex. But it was clear that, you know, there being oral sex and there was, you know, sperm on dress and all of that. This created such a scandal in the world that women became divided about what, would you stand by him? Would you stand by him publicly? Was she doing women a disservice by standing beside him and still being his wife and not leaving him? Or was she showing strength and loyalty and doing what she should do?
Which is kind of the central thesis of then the next seven seasons of television, all built around that one dramatic argument. It's incredible.
It is, and it's because it's a really fundamental one about feminist argument about what to do. And I suppose as a human being, you know, to find your own independence outside that. But we're told by Diane that she's going to struggle to do this. But Diane turns around and, having said that she's got this baggage, turns around and points to a photo that she's got of Hillary Clinton, who is clearly one of her idols, in her room, in her office, and she says, "Well, if she can do it, so can you." And so that was the way that I suppose the creators decided everybody's going to be sitting out there in audience land saying, "Oh, this is based on Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. That's what the show is based on, and they've stolen that story." But by acknowledging it and showing that they are referencing that, and that the character can be referenced through that, they were taking the curse off that for themselves and saying, we know, obviously that's what it's based on, but we're saying we're tipping our hat to that. And I think that that was a really good decision as well.
So lessons that you could take out for, you know, so for a writer from this as an example, could you summarize what you just talked about, like the key takeaways from the Good Wife pilot first 10 pages and what it does so well and what lessons can be learned?
Show, don't tell. It'd probably be the primary lesson, and that, you know, that's script writing 101. We're not in a novel. We're in a television. Well, we're in a screen. We're on a screen, so you can convey so much without saying anything. And the audience doesn't even know that they're being told these things. They don't. They're not even aware when they see that rock and that Chanel thing that they're not having the conscious thought, "Oh, she's rich," or whatever. They're just taking it in and subconsciously understanding all these things about the characters. They're not breaking it down the way that we are now. And I think you need to trust, like, to look for the details. Yes, Kia, you're right. The details, there's a suggestion. But really, I think it's fabulous if a writer can actually think about what the character's wearing, actually think about ways of showing where they are at in that moment in their life. How rich are they? How poor are they? What, you know, so what's their socioeconomic standing? How do they wear their hair? Where are they situated? What sort of environment? And then to resist the urge to speak. Resist the urge to have exposition. Trust your actors. Trust your, you know, I suppose you don't have to tell them everything. And this is unfortunate. In Australia, we are asked to use exposition a lot. But try to find ways to convey everything about a character in a really short space of time without using words. I think that's a good exercise anyway. And, in fact, even at university, and I was asked, you know, to do that in script writing, you write that same scene again but take out all the dialogue. Just take out the dialogue and see what happens.
Oh, that's a good exercise for whatever, any project you've got on the go. Mm-hmm. See if you can do it.
Mm-hmm. And I would add to that, just in terms of the summary of what the script does so well, is that it is controlling what the camera does. It is controlling what the actors do. It is controlling pace and tone without ever being overbearing with it. Just in the choice of an adjective, you know, saying that something like, whiplashed, Alicia spins around. Like, just the word whiplash tells you that this is frantic, it's pacey. So there's so much control being exhibited in how this is going to end up on screen, just in the choice of words and the way the big print is written, I think.
Yeah, the layout is also important, as you're pointing out, Kia. And I think, you know, you should make choices. It's really interesting for me that this far down the track, I'm an overwriter. I will always write too many pages. And sometimes because of that, I'm inclined to go back and take spacing out. But the best scripts are written with the big print that you need to land given air and the words you need to land and the sounds you need to land shown separately. And so the structure, what you choose to put on a single line, we'll land that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really essential to have those kind of cues for people, for directors and actors.
Well, usually at this stage we'd move on to a segment called The Next 10 and Must Mentionables. But since it's... we've done a TV show for the first time ever, and we've gone further into depth than I think we have any other project, which I'm very grateful for, Sarah. But I think we might move towards the end of the show.
Yeah, we've taken up enough of your time, and I think it's indicative that, you know, the pace, like what they've done in the first, you know, 2 pages is what a feature film might spend the first 15 pages doing. And that's just, you know, very indicative of the way the differences between the formats, film and television.
So, and it doesn't feel
really
rushed,
valuable. No.
Which I think is an amazing thing they've pulled off. It all feels quite natural.
Mm.
It was quite interesting for me. I was watching it again. I watched it again just before we got on, but I was watching it again last night, and I was watching it with an actor. just happened to be in the, in that space. And that actor hadn't seen the show before. And so it was fresh eyes. And despite it being 10 years old or 11 years old now, and TV having moved way beyond that in sophistication levels, with no disrespect to the Kings, I'm just talking about procedural television and network television, that actor was like, I was happy to turn it off after the first 2 minutes or 3 minutes, and they didn't want to, because that opening hooked them in completely. They were totally engaged.
Well, they've got 156 episodes to look forward to. Sarah Walker, thank you so much for joining us on the first 10 pages. It's been a great honour.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
No, it's a pleasure and privilege to be asked. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.